This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Now, Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. It's a beautiful Monday morning here in the People's Republic of Little Beirut, as George Herbert Walker Bush referred to Portland, Oregon, broadcasting live from our home studios at AM 620 KPOJ, nationwide, coast to coast, and streaming around the planet at airamerica.com as well. Our quote for the day from Joe Wilson: "Well, I take great pride in being an American, and I don't believe either party has a monopoly on wisdom." That's a good, reasonable quote for the day. A lot in the news: George W. Bush, his administration, Fred Fielding, his lawyer, who, by the way, was John Dean's assistant. John Dean was Nixon's lawyer, and John Dean, of course, got canned. So Fred Fielding was Nixon's lawyer during Watergate. Is this, do we need to play woo-woo music here? Fred Fielding advising the Bush administration, invoke executive privilege. They are not going to allow Harriet Myers and Sarah Taylor to talk to Congress. So we'll see if today the Senate, if Pat Leahy issues some citations for contempt of Congress and where that goes. Quite a few other things in the news as well, which we will be getting into as the program continues. But it's interesting, yesterday on the front page of our paper here in Portland, the Oregonian, big screaming headline about how left-wing talk radio, I'm paraphrasing from memory, I don't have the story in front of me, but, left-wing talk radio wants to bring back the Fairness Doctrine. I saw similar articles in newspapers in Michigan, in Virginia, all across the country, it appears. And now members of Congress, Mike Spence, the congressman from Indiana, the Republican from Indiana, Greg Walden, a Republican congressman from Oregon, and a number of others have introduced legislation to make it illegal for the federal government to spend any money enforcing a fairness doctrine if it were brought back. And on this topic, Horace Cooper is with us. He's a senior fellow with the American Civil Rights Union. TheACRU.org is their website. This is the conservative version of the American Civil Liberties Union. Horace Cooper, welcome.
Thank you for having me on your show today.
You're welcome. You guys posted an article here, the ACRU on the air, and exposing the liberal assault on talk radio. First of all, what is the liberal assault on talk radio?
Yeah, well, I wanted to quibble just a little bit with the intro. Our concern had little to nothing to do with talk radio and liberal advocacy happening on talk radio. Our concern was more about the fact that this proposal put forward by the Center for American Progress is really simply what I would observe to be an acknowledgement that there's been a failure in the marketplace to win in talk radio numbers, and therefore decisions made by this group at least to advocate, let's just change the rules. We don't like what came out in the outcome of fair and open competition. Let's change the rules and let's get rid of our competition rather than let's defeat them by offering a superior product.
We must be reading the same document and coming to completely different conclusions here. First of all, the Center for American Progress, just for our listeners who don't know, the Center for American Progress did a study. Paul Woodhull, who also syndicates Bill Press's show and Radical Russ's show, which originates from here, Paul Woodhull came out and the report itself and said, we're not calling for a return of the Fairness Doctrine. They explicitly said it. It's in the report.
Oh,
Paul
no,
has said
I would
in
argue
a dozen different
is,
press releases.
I think you're right about that. This goes much further than that.
Well, and number one. And number two, what this study found was that progressive talk radio, which has only been around for 5 years for all practical purposes and only been around in any really significant way since the creation of Air America Radio, which was, what, 2 years ago?
Okay.
Now has captured 10% of the total radio market. I would say that's fabulously successful. Our show is growing like crazy. A lot of other progressive shows are growing like crazy. Progressive talk radio is doing really well. And that point, I think, was made in there. And, I don't get it why this report, which points out that 90% of the talk radio out there is conservative, whereas just 5 years ago, 100% of the talk radio out there was conservative.
Okay.
This report is suddenly got all the conservatives in America hysterical, saying that, you know, we're calling for the Fairness Doctrine or something, when none of us are calling for the Fairness Doctrine.
Okay,
hey, we're doing well.
Now we're now talking past one another. All right, let me be very clear. My comments have absolutely nothing to do with talk radio from a liberal perspective. My comments and our concerns are directed at the Center for the American Progress's report. No criticism here of talk radio from a liberal perspective. Now,
you say the Center for American Progress wants the government to compel a balance between progressive and conservative
content.
Yes,
that's what I believe this report recommends.
It doesn't recommend that. What it says is that they believe that one of the reasons why 90% of talk radio is conservative right now is because of ownership. Frankly, they're suggesting, and I'm not sure I agree with them. In all this, I think that 90% of talk radio is conservative because of a herd mentality in this industry. I've been in this industry since 1968, and programmers are afraid to take chances. There's just an enormous herd mentality. So when Limbaugh was successful, all the programmers, you know, back 15 years ago, and not without some considerable effort, by the way. His first 2 years, he was not all that successful. But when he finally caught on, and then they said, hey, we want the same thing, only different. And so, you know, they got Hannity, and then they got Liddy, and then they got, and you know, and it grew. And now the same thing's happening on the left side. And frankly, I think that that's just a natural and normal trend. But the conclusion of the Center for American Progress was that the concentration of media in a small number of hands might have something to do with the reason why there's so much conservative talk radio, that progressive shows get put on small stations, conservative shows get put on big 50,000-watt stations, progressive shows are on little 5,000-watt stations. But I would point out that's not always the case, by the way. We're on a number, this show is on a number of 25,000 watts KPOJ. I think it's either 25 or 50,000 watts, the Quake in San Francisco, 50,000 watts K-Talk in Los Angeles. We're on a number of very, very large stations live, and they're doing well. They're doing very well. So,
okay.
You know, I just, I don't get it. I don't get it why you guys are so freaked out. Why Republicans are introducing legislation in Congress to try and prevent us from doing anything.
Okay, I'm not going to play the victim. I'll play instead the polite card. Can I talk?
Sure.
Okay. One of the things that disturbs us is if a group like, say, the Heritage Foundation had come up with a report and took exactly the stats you just cited, that in 5 short years, talk radio has brought from the left from nothing to almost 10% of the market. Where could that be going? And they recommended to the government, to federal officials, that there be some response to this phenomenon. Don't you think that would be troubling?
It would depend on the recommendation. The recommendation that the Center for American Progress came up with is one that,
while it's
applied to the media, I would say broadly, I'm concerned about not just media consolidation. I'm concerned about corporate consolidation, period. You know, the Walmarts of the planet. We no longer have small family-owned businesses in America because we're in a state of virtual monopoly in this country. You know, forget about the media. I mean, this is right across the board. That's my issue.
Right.
And so I think the answer to a whole variety of problems is let's reinforce the Sherman Act that Reagan stopped enforcing after 120 years.
You're saying that you and your listeners would not be troubled by a report coming out from the Heritage Foundation that specifically says one problem we're working on is this spiraling, phenomenal growth of left-wing talk radio. It's a problem that the government needs to respond to. That wouldn't be troubling at all.
You know, come on, the Heritage Foundation, I've spoken at the Heritage Foundation several times. I've done a couple of radio debates there. I've done my show from there. Those guys, funded with money from SCAFE and Joe Coors way back in the day, they have been advocating loudly and aggressively and successfully in the media for conservative causes forever.
I've never challenged their right to do that. They
suggest legislation.
If they said that the problem that they're identifying is this phenomenal growth in left of center or progressive talk radio, here's what I want to make clear.
It's a strong question.
Our concern is that it is fundamentally constitutionally suspect for the government to respond to and take action based not on an identifiable issue, maybe you define one as corporate concentration and ownership, but instead on the actual ideological and partisan output of the speech. That is a very, very dangerous problem.
And nobody's calling for that. Nobody is calling for a return of the fairness doctrine.
Says we are identifying a problem. This problem, talk radio dominated by the right.
Yeah, but nobody
That's
is calling for
and then
for any kind of
solution.
Nobody's calling for any kind of political litmus test. Well, people can read about it over at your website. Horace Cooper, senior fellow of the American Civil Rights Union, theacru.org. Horace, thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you for having me on today. Appreciate it.
16 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Radio. Radio,
21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. This is just incredible. I mean, it was right screaming headline on the front page of our local paper yesterday. I went online, and it's from papers from Virginia and Michigan to Oregon. I mean, all over the country. Newspapers actually editorializing.
Oh, we got to stop this liberal assault on conservative talk radio. The liberals are out to get conservative talk radio. They're trying to bring back the fairness doctrine.
No. I don't know of anybody who's trying to bring back the fairness doctrine. I think that there should be a good, healthy discussion about concentration of wealth and concentration of corporate power. And frankly, I think it should go way beyond the media. And as I said, I don't even think that that's a problem. I used to be a program director. I mean, it was 30 years ago, but I know, the people in this industry, in the radio industry, are very, very concerned about change. No, nobody ever got fired for keeping their station doing what it's doing. And a lot of people have lost their jobs. A lot of program directors have lost their jobs over the years for changing to a new format that fails. And so people are afraid to try new things. It's just, it's a very cautious industry. And but the reality is, and this is really an important point to make, the reality is, a lot of ratings trends just came out last week, and on virtually every radio station that this show is carried live on, we're seeing increases in ratings, and our advertisers are happy. They're getting good, strong response. I mean, we've got Small Dog Electronics has been advertising with us almost 4 years. Sacred Grounds Coffee has been advertising with us about a year. They're getting great results. The Organic Wine Company has been advertising with us for over 3 years. They're getting great results. I mean, it works. Progressive talk radio works. And it works in particular on those larger stations, just like conservative talk radio works in the larger stations in the larger metro areas anyway, where the stations program it and they say, yeah, we're going to run this like a real radio station. We're actually going to image it, have introductions and liners and promos and things, and we're going to promote it in the local community, buy a little advertising, put up some billboards, stuff like that, and carry good talent. And, yeah, of course, there's an ongoing process of shakeout in progressive talk radio, just like there has been in conservative talk radio for 15 years. Where some talent comes and some talent goes. Some people rise to the top, some people fall to the bottom. That's normal. That's the evolutionary process. But it's incredible to me how this study that was done by the Center for American Progress, which accurately documented the fact that in the 10 markets that they looked at, there were some 3,000 hours, more than 3,000 hours. Actually, it was 2,570 hours and 15 minutes of conservative talk, compared to 254 hours of progressive talk. And what they didn't point out was that a lot of that conservative talk was on these giant 50,000-watt heritage stations, these boomers like WABC out of New York City. And then the progressive talk is on, much smaller stations that frankly, not as many people can hear. I mean, just because they physically can't hear them. And, that's a structural, and they point out there's some structural concern. Well, there's a structural problem. But the fact of the matter is that Progressive Talk Radio has gone from nothing. I mean, I started this show. We're in our fifth year now. I started the show 4.5 years ago. And we were syndicated by the IE America Radio Network originally, which was owned by the UAW. They stopped programming the week that Air America started. It was sort of, you know, the UAW, the previous president had died, and he was the guy who was the big advocate for it. And the new guy just said, let's go back to being a union, and which was, I think was a, you know, good choice for them. And our show has continuously and steadily grown. We've been on Sirius Satellite for over 4 years. We've been on radio stations from coast to coast for 4.5 years. The show works. Progressive Talk Radio works. And all these newspapers, all these right wings,
Progressive Talk Radio is failing. It's going down the tank, and these guys are trying to rescue it with, you know.
Come on. The frankly, in my opinion, the only thing that Progressive Talk Radio needs, and this is the exact same thing that was happening the last the first year. I remember when Rush Limbaugh started out, and toward the end of his first year, maybe in the beginning of his second year, presumably when the funding was running out, and it had to make it or break it on its own, he was calling out to his listeners. And I remember because I was listening. He's calling out to his listeners. Hey, let our advertisers know that you're listening. Let our radio stations know that you're listening. You know, support this program. And he was just, I mean, every day he was going on. We're under assault from the liberals. You've got to get it. And people did. And they let their stations know that they were listening. And they let their stations know that they cared about the program. Conservatives did. And the show then took off. And then all these, you know, imitators came along. And then an entire genre was born. And I just say that the, you know, we're going through the exact same learning curve or evolutionary curve or whatever you want to call it, and that the reason that it took 12, 13 years, from the origination of Limbaugh's show in 87 till now, or till Progressive Talk Radio came about, is because people in the industry are just cautious. It takes a while to try something out new. But it's here. We're here. We're working. We're doing well. And by the way, it's all thanks to you. So enough on that. We'll take some calls and get back into the news of the day. It's the Tom Hartman program. Doing just fine. Thank you very much. On Air America Radio, which is also doing fine. Thank you very much.
This is the Tom Hartman program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Nothing on. Soft and slow, you and me and the last down low. We're nothing on but the radio.
Talking about the radio. And by the way, drop over to airamerica.com and then click on the Tom Hartman page, or click on my name. It'll take you to the Tom Hartman page. And join our blog. Start blogging. Put you in the running for David's pick of his favorite blog entry for the day. So that we'll, and that person will receive an autographed copy of Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, my newest book. So get over there to airamerica.com and click on over to the Tom Hartman page and start participating in our blog. I think you'll find it very interesting. I just want to say one more time, I think that, you know, God bless them for doing it, you know, the Center for American Progress and doing this study. I just think that it got played wrong. And it would be really interesting to see if it had been played the other way. I mean, essentially it was played like, you know, oh, we've only got 10%. Isn't that a shame? I'm a businessman. You know, I've run businesses for 30 years, and some of them very successful, some not so. Yeah, that's, you know, the nature of being an entrepreneur. If I started a new soft drink, you know, started bottling something in my garage, Tom Hartman's root beer, and within 3 years I had taken 10% of Coca-Cola's market, nationwide, I guarantee you my picture would be on the cover of Forbes magazine. The Wall Street Journal would be writing articles about this new startup success. Taking 10% of a marketplace in just 3 years, a marketplace that has existed for, you know, decades, that's enormous. And frankly, I think that if they had played it that way, then you would see conservatives running around going, oh my God, look at this, they're growing too fast. We've got to do something about it. Steve in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I'm down here in Atlanta where we get, I mean, zero, you know.
Yeah, you guys used to have a station that carried Air America, and it got bought out by a group of Christian broadcasters.
Yeah, well, like you said before the break, I mean, you know, it wasn't advertising. You know, it wasn't putting up billboards or anything like that. You know, it wasn't even trying. So it was no wonder it's going to get bought out. And but getting back onto what you're saying, you know, here in Georgia, where allegedly 35% to 40% of the populace votes Democratic, you'd think that, you know, somebody would put out a radio station that gets 40% of the populace out there.
Well, and they it'll happen eventually. I think that the reason why that station in Georgia, in Atlanta, went down, frankly, I don't think it was so much that it was run by conservatives who didn't want the format to succeed. I think it was that it was run by very cautious programmers who were afraid to put the resources into really trying to make the format work, because they didn't believe that it would work. Mm-hmm. And as more and more radio stations figure out that this stuff is working, that this format is working, that you can make money at it if you do it right, if you program radio stations like real radio stations and you actually put them on a good sized stick and you actually, that it is going to continue to grow. In fact, you know, we just picked up 3 new affiliates in the last month or so. Yeah. And this format is growing, and I'm telling you, KPOJ here, the station that I originate from and where I also do a local show in the morning, was the very first Air America affiliate 3 years ago. They were the very first station. And Clear Channel, which owns KPOJ, put it on a 25,000-watt stick. That's a major signal in the Portland area. And Mike Dirks, the guy who programs the station, is a genius. He's one of the best programmers in the business, and he focused on like a laser on promoting that thing, and it went to number one in the market in the first book that it came out. The number one station in the market, and is consistently now in the top 10 in the market, and has been making money since day one. Now, you would think that all around the world programmers would look, or all around the country programmers would look at that and say, gee, what's he doing right? And that's what's happening slowly. But I would say that those guys in Atlanta just, you know, they didn't come out here and say, hey, Mike, what are you doing right? They didn't bother to do their homework, so they didn't put the money into it. They put it on a good stick, and therefore it failed. I mean, it's just fairly predictable. So we need to get the success stories out. That's my take on it. I that's where we need to go. Ann in Orange County, and thanks, Steve, for the call. Ann in Orange County, California. Hey, Ann.
Good morning. I wish I was as optimistic as you, but I think that there's things that trump money in this situation, and one is the message. And I don't think that we have the time to delay informing our electorate. We have a corporate media monopoly that has an agenda, and they're happy with the message that's going out. And you're assuming that just because it's right-wing that left-wing people aren't listening. And I don't think that they're assuming that. I think they're assuming that they're getting people to listen to their message.
Actually, one of the things that the advent and existence of progressive talk radio has caused ideologues, politicians, and consultants to discover is that the assumption that they had that progressives were listening to Limbaugh, but they never called in because Limbaugh's screener just kept them all out, isn't true. By and large, progressives just don't bother to listen to Limbaugh, and by and large, conservatives don't listen to liberal talk radio. I'm just amazed. Because I constantly say if conservatives call, they go to the front of the line. I'll put them on the air, and they just don't call. I don't think there's that many listening.
Which is another reason we need to get our. I think the fairness doctrine will ensure that people in whatever market they're in will get a well-balanced input of information. And we have people that, you know, they did the study about the Fox News viewers and how misinformed they are. And we have progressive stations that were number one in their slots that were taken out. Who was it, Wisconsin, that just fought to get their station back?
Madison, yeah, and they were. And again, that was just an example, I think, of a station that wasn't being run like a real radio station.
But
because they had great ratings and they weren't selling the advertising. But here's the problem with the fairness doctrine. I started in radio in 68 as a DJ, and then in 1971 I started doing news, and for 7 years I did news, and then became a program director. And while I was doing news on what was the number one station in Lansing, Michigan. It was a country and western station, and they had an afternoon talk show. And that afternoon talk show, because of the fairness doctrine, never dealt with politics. because it was just a mess.
That. But when we have media that's willing to lie on such a grand scale, I think we need both. I think we need to work on our consolidation, but that could take decades to unwind, and we need to get people informed. I think it's an emergency situation on our media. It's like
no, I don't disagree with you, and I think the solution is the Sherman Act, frankly, and I think it's an emergency situation not just in our media, but in our retailing sector, in our manufacturing sector, in our wholesale sector, you know, right across the board. I think all across America. But if you had a fairness doctrine in place right now, what, I'm gonna have to make sure that 50% of this show is conservative in content?
Well, if that's what it takes, you know.
I don't think that's right. I wouldn't like that.
I understand. And
I'm telling you, I worked under that.
But if it ensures that 50% of Fox viewers and Limbaugh viewers and all
Well, see, Fox is claiming right now that they are the, and perhaps accurately, that they have, Fox News, that they have more liberals on than any other media, period. And, well, they're right. They've got Alan Combs on. And very often they'll go out and find the most inarticulate, uninformed, quote, liberals, end quote, that they can find and put them on the air and make fools of them. And then they say, see, we've got liberals. And that's again, my concern about a fairness doctrine is who gets to decide? Who gets to decide?
We can always get rid of it. But, you know, in the beginning, we need all point attack on this. We are in a desperate straits. We have people that are totally uninformed.
Yeah, no, I agree that we have people who are totally uninformed, and it's a bad thing for America. And I am just seeing, you know, not only so much success in radio, but also the blogosphere. I mean, it's just right across the board. I think America is waking up. But Ann, your point is well taken, and I appreciate your call. Thank you very much. Tim in Detroit, Michigan, listening on 1310 AM in Detroit. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, actually, I called about the Sherman Antitrust Act myself, and I think the government should not just look at it, you know, via the media monopolies that exist, but also through the telecom companies, through the various, you know, store chain companies. And there has to be a serious review about how actually, you know, capital is distributed, and we have to kind of, you know, have legislation, maybe hold hearings, and really look into how monopolization has increased in the last 20 years.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I've, you know, I've been singing that song for a long time, and you know, that you could put a point on it, and I think, frankly, the Center for American Progress did, that has something to do with what's going on in media. But I just don't think that it's limited to media. I think that that's a larger issue. As far as progressive talk radio, as I said, if I had started a new soft drink and I took 10% of Coca-Cola's market in 3 years, I'd be on the cover of Forbes. If I started a new line of tennis shoes and I took 10% of Phil Knight's Nike market within 3 years, you know, the Wall Street Journal would be banging on my door. They'd be doing a special about me on the evening news. I mean, just think about it for a minute. You've got something brand new, and in 3 years it takes 10% of the national market. That's huge. That's a huge success. Yeah, there have been a few road bumps along the way, but that's a huge success. So 1-866-303-2270, Mike in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Mike.
How you doing, man? I was actually, you kind of covered my point already, honestly. So,
Okay. All righty. Well, thank you very much.
No, you know, it's okay. I was waiting on hold long enough that I, you know, what are you going to do?
Well, I appreciate your call, Mike, and thanks for your kind words. Wayne in Tennessee. Hey, Wayne, we got about a half a minute here before we got to take a break. What's up?
Yeah, I was wondering why the Democrats would bring back the Fairness Doctrine when they were the ones who got rid of it. And
actually, it was Nixon who got rid of it.
The Fairness Doctrine was gotten rid of in
I'm sorry, it was Reagan who got rid of it. Yeah, it was 86, I think, was when Reagan made the change, and it was an administrative change that was done through the FCC, through his appointees.
Yeah, but the Democrats had control of Congress, and they are the ones who regulate the.
But see, the Fairness Doctrine is not a law that was passed by Congress.
But
it was a regulatory rule that was part. My understanding of it, I may be wrong on this, but I don't think so. I think it was a regulatory rule that the FCC promulgated.
Yeah, but it's right up there with you saying that Jimmy Carter got rid of, broke up AT&T, and that was a Justice Department thing that started in 1969. I mean, that's
yeah, you're right. You're right. You're right about that. But this was something that Reagan was, you know, this was the Fairness Doctrine was on Reagan's hit list, and you know, and it's gone. So, you know, I just don't think that bringing back the Fairness Doctrine is the solution. I think the solution is for us to just keep doing what we're doing because we're having success, and to point out those successes, to trumpet those successes. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
Conservative Christian, right-wing Republican, straight white American males. Soul-saving, flag-waving, rush this democracy. From tree-hugging, peace-loving, pot-smoking, barefooting folks singing hippies like me.
Yes. Here we are, the tree huggers. Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you. I would, in the chat room, people are talking about this, and several folks pointed out that there are some members of Congress who in the past few years have called for return of the Fairness Doctrine. Virtually all of them, to the best of my knowledge, and I've talked with a number of them, and I know a number of them, have changed and said, no, we're not in favor of having, literally having a government employee determine what is conservative and what is liberal and tell radio stations how much of each they have to carry, which would essentially be a return to the Fairness Doctrine. Instead, what they are suggesting is that we should have programming in the public interest, which is a return to, and this, by the way, would require rolling back part of Clinton's 1996 Telecommunications Act, as well as Reagan, as well as some of the things that Reagan did. We should go back to programming in the public interest. That is making sure that radio stations and television stations, and for that matter, in my opinion, cable companies that use public rights of way rather than public airways, are actually providing news. That's the primary way that public, you know, the programming in the public interest is done, is through actual news rather than infotainment. But I think that the realm of talk radio, and it will take care of itself. And frankly, I think that one of the reasons why newspapers all across the country over the weekend had these articles about how Mike Spence in Indiana and Greg Walden in Oregon and all these other Republican members of Congress are getting all hysterical, passing a law to forbid the United States to have a fairness doctrine or to use money to enforce it. The reason that they're doing it is because they're really worried about the fact that we've gone from nothing to 10% of the market in just 3 years. As I said, that's a phenomenal success story. And I think it's got a lot of conservatives very, very worried. Richard in New York. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. You know, for years I've been hearing these conservatives scream and rant about let the market decide. Well, somebody needs to check them on that concept, because when you're boycotting Air America, when you're blacklisting sponsors, that's not letting the market decide.
Well, let me point out that the blacklist and what you're talking about, this got a lot of publicity about 2 years ago, that there is a blacklist of, ad agencies that say, you know, these particular companies don't want to advertise on Air America Radio. I'll tell you, there's an almost identical blacklist for Limbaugh's show. Those are not companies that don't want to support liberal talk radio. They're companies that don't want their company involved in anything political whatsoever. There are companies that don't want to advertise on the Dr. Laura show. There are companies that don't want to advertise on the Howard Stern show back when he used to be on terrestrial radio.
That's the companies that you're talking about. That's fine. I'm talking about the groups out there led by local pastors, religious groups, whatever the case might be, who literally have their congregations, their supporters calling up sponsors, calling up advertisers, saying if I'm not going to buy your product because you advertise on, liberal.
Yeah, and that happens from time to time. But the flip side of that is that so many, we just got a letter last week from one of our advertisers saying that this company's been in business 35 years. Well, it was Sacred Grounds Coffee, who advertises on this show. He said they've been in business 35 years, and they've never before had anybody call up and say, thank you for advertising. He said, this is wonderful. We're getting loyal customers, people who actually not only care about the product, but care about the fact that we're out there, supporting the medium. And so the extent to which you can let our advertisers know that you appreciate the programming and that even if you're not going to buy the product, you're going to recommend it to others. And the extent to which you can let the program directors know of your radio stations that you like progressive talk radio and that you're willing to support it. And hey, let's put on some events. Let's get something going here in town. I mean, that's what makes it work. And it is working. Don in Northern California. Hey, Don.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Tom. Gosh, I'm glad I got through. Listen, I want to cut right to the heart of the issue that you're talking about here, and even you haven't brought it up, but the basic fundamental issue is there is no liberal press.
There is. It's in the blogosphere.
Let me finish my thought, because... Okay. We're talking about an ownership situation, and all of the newspapers are owned by Murdoch or whoever. All of the radio stations, obviously, are being controlled. All of the major TV is controlled. You can't turn on the TV without getting assaulted by propaganda. That's what
right. We have a corporate press in the United States. I don't disagree with that. There, you know, I guess the liberal press is like the Nation magazine.
Well,
you know.
Yeah, but this is the thing. I listened to Limbaugh for years, trying to keep my enemy close to me, and it's always he's always bringing it up. You know, the big lie about the liberal press. And they just distort the news and the facts to whatever suits their purpose.
Well, it is a big lie, and now they actually have a liberal media presence, which is us.
Right.
And they're hysterical about it. I mean, they're just absolutely freaking out about it. They're like I said, Mike Spence and Greg Walden actually put in legislation to stop us. I mean, this is incredible. Don, good point. Thank you very much. Diane in Alabama. Hey, Diane.
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air, and we've got about a minute.
All right. I think primarily you were talking about the ownership issue. I think that's really where we need to go is on – let me turn this down. All right. Is the ownership rather than the content. I don't see how anyone could possibly clearly determine what the content is in any kind of way that would be even remotely honest. And I think if we would limit how much of the percentage of the market someone can own and also make it more available to local – ownership, because I know where we live,
the thing that I think should be done first, absolutely first, is more low power FM licenses. But that's something that is being fought vigorously by the people at National Public Radio, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. They're lobbying against that. They don't. Oh man, they don't want that to happen. So, but again, I would just say, I think an awful lot of this stuff is just debris. It's the chaff. The real issue is, we've gone from nothing to 10% of the market in just a couple of years, and we're continuing to grow, and they're freaked out about it. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Some extraordinary news this morning in the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, that I was so blown away by this. I just said to Louise and David, we're going to do an hour on this. This is globalization destroying America? For that matter, is it destroying the world? I believe that all the evidence is pointing to an answer, an absolutely unassailable answer of yes. And not just in the environmental sense, although that's very real. I mean, and fortunately, we've got, I think it's MSN perhaps is now claiming 10 million web streams of live Earth over the weekend. Isn't that great? I mean, an Al Gore out there, saying, hey, let's protect the world. Well, that's fine. And what about protecting, for example, local economies? There is one of these, free trade, Milton Friedman, Tom Friedman, world is flat crazies, opining in the Financial Times today about what a wonderful thing this is, by the way. The headline is A Cleverer Way to Build a Boeing. And he talks about the rollout of the first Boeing 787 in Everett, Washington yesterday. He says it's a triumph for the company. Boeing itself is responsible for about 10% by value, the tail fin and final assembly of this new plane. In other words, Boeing, we Americans used to think of as an American company, making an American product. I mean, the Boeing 707 only had 2% of the value of that airplane was made outside the United States. This Boeing 787, 90% of it made outside the United States. The wings are built in Japan. The landing gear is built in France. The fuselage is built in Italy. Isn't globalization wonderful? Well, Tell that to the Boeing workers who have been laid off. 38,000 jobs have been dumped in the United States by Boeing just since 2001. 38,000 jobs. In fact, Boeing now no longer refers to itself as a manufacturer. According to this article, they call themselves a systems integrator. Mr. Pritchard, David Pritchard, researcher at the State University of New York, is quoted in the article as lamenting the strategic destruction of the U.S. aerospace industry, arguing that Boeing is giving away intellectual property in return for capital. It's helping suppliers in Japan and China to develop technology that they will use to make their own aircraft. The company has sacrificed U.S. leadership in a crucial export industry. And then Mr. John Gapper, the guy in Financial Times who's saying, no, 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 it's wonderful what they're doing. He says the 787 program has no doubt helped these suppliers to develop expertise that they will sell to others. But that is the way of the world. Don't you get it? The internationalists have taken over. The big transnational corporations, they're not even transnational corporations. They're global corporations. They're bigger than countries. The 100 largest economies in the world, more than half of them are corporations now. They're not countries. He says, Boeing is following the right path in an industry that is going global. He quotes Adam Smith. He actually misquotes Adam Smith. And he says, the company is doing what Adam Smith admired in The Wealth of Nations, profiting from the division of labor. Well, Adam Smith's argument about the division of labor was within an economy. He says, Nike pioneered the outsourcing of manufacturing of sports shoes to Japan and China. Oh, wasn't that wonderful? Yeah, we used to make shoes in the United States. We don't anymore. Apple and others got suppliers in Taiwan and China to make their consumer electronic goods. We used to make televisions in the United States. We used to make radios in the United States. We invented the transistor. I remember the CK-722 back when I was a 13-year-old ham radio operator in the 1960s. The first transistors came out. Oh, this is so cool. You know, we were building things. We don't even make them in the United States anymore. He says, there are reasons for Boeing's workers to regret the trend. A job in an aircraft assembly plant or a laboratory working on new materials is worth more than one in a textile plant. Yeah, about that. He says, it pays better and supports other jobs in the air. Yes. He says, but this is not a zero-sum game. Boeing is shedding manufacturing jobs, but is adding well-paid services jobs. Oh, my. Oh, so that's one. Here's another one. This is, you know, people say, oh, you should. The government should not be involved in the energy industry. Should not be involved in promoting, for example, wind power. We should just let the free market decide. That's what they've been. That's what the cons have been saying in the United States. And as a result of that, up until this last Congress, there have been virtually no government subsidies, no consistent major federal subsidies for wind power or solar power. We subsidize nuclear power hugely. I mean, the Price-Anderson Act. Nuclear power plants are so dangerous they can't even buy. There is no private insurance company in the world that will insure a nuclear power plant, period, for any price. So we the people do. That's what the Price-Anderson, they had to say, we will insure them. Huge subsidies, $10, $12 billion subsidies in the last energy bill for the oil and coal and gas industries. So here's this little company. Community Energy, Inc., a company in Wayne, Pennsylvania. This is the front page of today's Wall Street Journal. Alternative energy hurt by a windmill shortage. An article by Keith Johnson. He's talking about Community Energy, Inc., a company in Wayne, Pennsylvania. He says when they've been trying for years to kickstart wind projects in the U.S. And all of a sudden they start getting business. And he says, but then they couldn't fulfill the orders. When it came to getting windmills, he faced a multi-year delay. He says, we were like an airline sitting there and being told we had to wait 3 years to get an airplane. So in late 2005, Mr. Alderfer, this is the president of the company, contacted Iberdrola S.A., a Madrid, Spain-based utility that has emerged as one of the world's leaders in renewable energy. 6 months later, Iberdrola purchased Community Energy, the American company, for $40 million. 2 months after that, the technicians had outfitted the company's stillborn project with gleaming white turbines that started churning out enough clean electricity for about 6,500 homes. So now all our profit from our windmill energy is going to Spain. In addition to the community energy, the article goes on, Iberdrola snapped up two other small U.S. developers last year in Iowa and Virginia. Last month, it entered into a deal to buy its first regulated U.S. utility company, Energy East Corp. of Portland, Maine, for $4.58 billion, in part to take advantage of U.S. tax credits for wind. See, because we have not been nurturing these alternative industries that Jimmy Carter put in place, the first legislation to nurture in 1979, and Reagan undid it. And the Republicans, when they took over Congress, said, no, ain't going to ever happen again. And it hasn't. But other companies have said, no, we're going to nurture these industries in Spain, in Germany, in France, in China. They go on to say, governments from Beijing to Sacramento are showering the sector with subsidies. Europe now plans to produce 20% of its energy from renewable sources by 2020. That's like 12 years from now, 14 years from now, 13 and a half years from now, up from about 6% today, with wind power playing the leading role. The U.S. lags behind other countries that have spent decades nurturing wind power with subsidies and price supports. This is why sometimes big government is a good idea. Or at least useful government, or at least government intervention in the so-called free market. If you want to have renewable power and you want it to be owned by American companies so that the profits stay in this country, well, we pretty much can't now. Spain, with 1/7 the population of the U.S., has the same amount of wind power. In the U.S., I mean, again, I'm quoting from this Wall Street Journal article, in the U.S., there's another potential threat to growth, erratic government support for wind power. There's no federal requirement for utilities to buy green energy as there is in the United Kingdom, Denmark, and Germany. So their governments have all intervened in the market. And the tax credit started in 1992 depends on a biannual congressional approval. In other words, you can't depend on it. What company is going to make a business plan that every other year could get blown out of the water? An effort to introduce federal support for wind power was shot down this month in the Senate. The lack of a stable long-term regulatory environment has created a wind power roller coaster. Now, just get what's going on. Earlier this year, Portuguese utility Energias de Portugal S.A., or EDP, paid $2.7 billion for the American company, Horizon Wind Energy of Houston. Aconia Energia S.A. of Spain bought Eco Energy LLC, a unit of the Morse Group of Freeport, Illinois, last month. It intends to roll out 1,500 megawatts, a billion watts of wind power in the Midwest over 3 years. And BP, British Petroleum Alternative Energy, a division of UK-based BP, snapped up Virginia-based Greenlight Energy Inc. last year for about $100 million. European companies are estimated to own 20% of all the wind energy in the U.S. What are we, nuts? 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Now, let me just lay this out in fairly simple and straightforward fashion and then give you the consequences of our failure to do this. When this country was founded in 1787, you know, a couple of years after we had won the Revolutionary War, but before the Constitution was ratified, it was ratified in 1789, Tench Coxe, he was a small businessman, in, as I recall, in Philadelphia. There's been one biography written of him that I read probably 10 years ago. Tench Coxe was America's first lobbyist. He was friends with all these guys who were the founders and the framers and the legislators and whatnot. And he was a small businessman. This was before there was even one person in America with a net worth of over $1 million in today's dollars, equivalent of today's dollars. That happened in 1790. So here we are in 1787. Tench Coxe gets passed through the Continental Congress a law that basically was a tariff on imported goods for the purpose of protecting American industries. And essentially what it said was, if you want to make a pair of shoes, that in the United States, if they're made in the United States, have a dollar's worth of labor in them. If you want to make them in Mexico, where it's 20 cents worth of labor, or if you want to make them in China, where it's 10 cents worth of labor, that's fine. We can't stop you from doing that. But when those shoes arrive at the border of this country, if they're coming in from Mexico, there's going to be an 80-cent import tax. And if they come in from China, there's going to be a 90-cent import tax. So no matter where you make them, it's going to cost you a dollar for the labor. So you can make them wherever you want. And of course, they did. I mean, people can, you know, Gucci has been selling shoes in the United States for 200 years. They're perfectly willing to pay. They've been perfectly willing to pay that fee. And Ferragamo and all these other brands. But by and large, in the mass market shoe industry, American shoe manufacturers existed for over 200 years. Why? Because they were a protected industry. As were, you know, T-shirt manufacturers and underwear manufacturers and shirt manufacturers and coat manufacturers and pants manufacturers. You can't buy a pair of blue jeans made in the United States anymore. Levi closed their last factory in the U.S. 2 years ago. I mean, actually, you can buy a pair of blue jeans made in the United States. There's one shop, actually a union shop, that makes them. And I have forgotten their name and URL, but I'm wearing a pair of their pants right now. And I'll track that down and I'll tell it to you tomorrow. But anyhow, the point is that by and large, we were protected by these import tariffs. And as a consequence of that, 100%, not only did it build American industry, not only did it from 1787 until Reagan started taking these things apart, and then Bush Sr. took them apart even further with trade deals, and then Clinton just kicked the door wide open with NAFTA and GATT and the WTO. Up until then, import tariffs provided 100% of the revenue that ran the federal government in the United States from the founding of this country until the Civil War. From the end of the Civil War, when the federal government got much larger, we went from a small central federal government and strong states and weak federal government to a strong federal government and weak states. There was a fundamental shift after the Civil War in the relative relationship between the federal and state governments. And so after the Civil War, from the time of the end of the Civil War until World War I, 2/3 of the total operating budget of the United States was paid for by tariffs. And our industries were protected. World War I, again, dramatically expanded the size of the federal government. So, you know, what's happening is the amount of money coming from tariffs is not going down. What's happening is the government's getting larger, and so they need other sources of income. Thus, the income tax around the time, you know, just before World War I and things like that. So from World War I till World War II, tariffs provided 1/3 of the total revenue of the federal government. And again, we had American industries. And then these guys came along with this, oh, the world is flat, kick down the doors. Let's run the government. Let's change our trade laws so that the main beneficiaries will no longer be the American worker. And will no longer be people who want to start small businesses in America, entrepreneurs. And will no longer be even American big businesses like General Motors. It'll be the transnational corporations, which General Motors became, or the international corporations, which Chrysler bought out by Mercedes-Benz. It'll become corporations that owe allegiance to no country. They will become the only beneficiaries, this so-called free trade. And as a consequence of this now, you know, so much of our food is coming from the United States, or is coming from China. This story from the Associated Press, China's food safety crisis has tarnished its reputation abroad. More health scares are expected, a top official was quoted as saying Monday. Sun Chuan-si, an official with the State Food and Drug Administration, in a seminar on Saturday said that future food safety accidents would likely be caused by residual pesticides and veterinary drugs in food, the use of industrial ingredients in food manufacturing, and dangerous bacteria. He listed domestic cases from the past year, including drug-tainted fish, banned Sudan dye used to color egg yolks red, and pork tainted with clenbuterol, a banned feed additive. It's like, you know, is nothing sacred, even our food supply? No, absolutely nothing is sacred on the altar of international laissez-faire capitalism. Just absolutely let it run amok, let it run roughshod over the interests of labor, over the interests of small and medium-sized businesses, and frankly, over the interests of the nation itself. Your call's next, 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
You can
34 minutes past the hour. Speaking of doing right, thanks for supporting our radio program by supporting our sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee over at sacredgroundscoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics over at smalldog.com, the Organic Wine Company, the Eco Wine, 1-888-ECO-WINE. Much appreciated. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Anthony in Everett, Washington. Hey, Anthony, what's up?
Oh, hey, Tom. I also wanted to kind of piggyback on what you were talking about with Boeing's big unveiling of the 787 yesterday. And
right.
That is and our politicians, and we're a blue state, we're a Democratic state, and yet our governors out there touting the fact that we enticed Boeing to stay here in this state by offering that, by giving them a $2 billion, you know, corporate welfare tax subsidy in order to entice them to stay here. I live right next to the Boeing, one of the Boeing fields here in Everett, and it's like they have their everything around, like all the roads and everything, anything they want, it's like perfectly paved, and if they need new access to I-5, it's built. But, you know, forget about all the rest of the infrastructure in the state. It's like anything Boeing wants, Boeing gets. And I wanted to kind of piggyback that on the fact that, you know, they laid off thousands of people here just a few years ago, and everybody was, you know, the houses were up for sale, and real estate prices took a nosedive, and it was just, you know, everything hinges on this one company being here. And I just, number one, I think that that's terrible for our economy to not be so diversified that we have to rely on this one, you know, entity to be here. It's kind of like, you know, those towns that rely on a military base or whatnot, you know?
I understand. And Anthony, your point is well made. And here's the bottom line for me. And I am not vilifying Boeing. Boeing, you know, it's a good company. It's well run. It's got good management. A lot of good people work there. And they're playing by the rules. Just like I don't vilify Walmart. I'm not going to say all those nice things about Walmart, but I don't vilify Walmart because they're playing by the rules. I mean, they get nailed when they don't. But the bottom line is we need to change the rules. Rather than directing our wrath or concern or anger or upset or whatever at any of these companies, I mean, these companies, they're simply, you know, the rules were changed. Reagan changed the rules with regard to the Sherman Act, the consolidation of large companies, and began changing the rules about foreign ownership of U.S. companies, foreign ownership of U.S. assets, particularly strategic assets, and the protection of U.S. jobs and U.S. industries. Reagan began that. Bush continued it. Clinton took it on steroids. And Bush Jr. has you know, shot it up with speed. I mean, it's incredible. And as a consequence, you've got companies just doing what companies do, making money. That's what they're supposed to do. So the level at which this stuff needs to be addressed, in my opinion, is the level of changing the rules of the game. I mean, that's the you know, very simple bottom line. Jim in Michigan. Hey, Jim.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I'm up here near Detroit. And, you know, it's interesting you talk all about Boeing and everything, but, you know, when Ford decided they were going to put a new head of their corporation, where'd they bring him from? Boeing.
Oh, interesting.
So what does that tell you is going to happen to Detroit? You know, what does that tell you?
Well, it's like, you know, GM is making cars right now with engines made in China.
Well, you know, what's really funny is I got a lot of cousins, you know, they're engineers at GM, and they always thought they were snug as a bug in the rug. You know, they're making their $125,000, $150,000. But now GM and these companies have decided that they only need about one-third as many engineers because they can work on the project during the day here, work on it for the next 8 hours in India, and then the next 8 hours in Russia, you know.
Yeah.
So the two-thirds of the work is done outside of here, and they just download it all on the computer, and whatever the Russians or the Indians did is on the computer the next day.
Yeah.
They just pick it up from there.
And there are 6.5 billion of us now on the earth. And how are the 300 million of us in the United States going to have any kind of a defined economy if all of our workers are competing against people where half the world's population lives on less than $2 a day and would leap at a chance to make $10 a day as a job? And we're going to protect our industries, and we're going to protect our jobs based on that. It's just not going to happen.
They're going to make it on the top 5% around the world.
Yeah, well, see, that, and that top 5% is just going to move around the world, you know, constantly, and well, that's a whole other rant. But, Jim, thank you. Your point well made, indeed. Scott in Indianapolis. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Tom. I like your show, even though I totally disagree with most of what you say.
Well, thank you.
Like, in the situation with Boeing, you know, Boeing is not or should not be a government company. I'm not saying they should be, Scott.
I'm saying that we should change our trade rules so that if a company wants to have most of their product made overseas, that they have to pay a tariff on the import of that part of the product that is equal to the cost of having the labor of having that part of the product made here in the United States.
I wish Milton Friedman was here to debate you. He's gone now, unfortunately. But you're so wrong on trade. In fact, you're wrong on a lot of issues.
Milton Friedman's principles are what has been in place since Reagan came into office in 81. And that's what's debating me. And you can look around. Look at what it's done to this country.
Look at the world. The world is going to be a better place with free trade.
It's not. Mexico's poverty has increased in Mexico since NAFTA.
China is turning into
a toxic waste site, and it's destroying the planet. They're producing more carbon dioxide than we do. The economists may not agree with me, but I'll tell you when John Maynard Keynes's ideas were running this country from the 1930s until 1981, when Reagan brought in basically Friedmanism. Back when it was Keynesianism, we had a strong middle class, we had an industrial infrastructure, we had innovation, we had small businesses, we had unique communities, had unique character and nature, and not just the United States. And those countries, by the way, in Western Europe, who are not following Friedman, but are still following Keynes and whatnot, are finding that they do have strong economies, and they are able to protect their economies and provide people with health care and decent jobs and pensions.
You're so wrong, Tom. Free trade is a good thing. Economists know that. They've been saying that year after year.
Why, Scott, is it a good thing for multinational corporations to make up the rules of trade rather than for governments?
Okay, first of all, you understand who created corporate law in the first place. It was government. Government, which you
exactly
defend when it comes to health care. You would love the government to take over decisions about your health care.
I would like for the government to be the health insurance company. Yeah, I'd like. I would love for all of us to have Medicare.
Like
every other industrialized country in the world does. But you just made my point, Scott. Corporations are creatures of government. We the people collectively, and government is us. We the people collectively said we are going to allow corporations to come into being because originally, and this used from the founding of this country until the 1890s, it was by law in every state in the union, it was required that in the corporate charter, their first statement of purpose be to serve the public interest.
This is just like
our last hour talking about programming and the public good. And corporations that didn't serve the public interest, in addition to making a profit, were routinely put out of business. An average of 2,000 companies a year got the death sentence in the United States leading up into the 1880s and 1890s when these laws were changed as a result of John Rockefeller pitting one state against each other in the charter mongering era.
The bad corporate laws were passed by government. Government is the problem. Too much government. Health care, we need to get the government out of health care. They're the ones that are following.
So you would rather have William Maguire, who makes $1.7 billion in compensation, you'd rather have him decide what kind of health care you're going to have, and knowing that the decision that he makes is going to make him more billions of dollars, even if it ends up with you dying. You'd rather have him making your decision than politicians who are responsive to you, who you can vote for every 2 years.
First of all, politicians are not necessarily responsive to me. But secondly,
because there's too much corporate money in the system.
I have choices in the market. I don't have choices with universal single-payer, government-payer system.
Sure you do.
The first thing to go in the government system is choice.
No, it's not.
The first thing
in Canada, you can buy private health insurance. In England, you can buy private health insurance. In France, in Germany, in Sweden, you can buy private health insurance if you want. Most people choose not to. The vast majority of people choose not to because the government-provided health insurance is works just great and it's less expensive.
That's the phenomenon of the free lunch. If I can get a free lunch,
it's the phenomenon
I'm not going to buy another lunch.
No, it's the fact that, Medicare can provide health insurance for 3% overhead because they don't have to pay 10% dividends to their stockholders. They don't have to pay a $1.78 billion paycheck to William McGuire. They don't have to pay for the gold-plated faucets and the corporate jets. They don't have to pay for advertising and promotion. They don't have to pay a legion of salespeople to try and convince you that what they've got is better than the other guy. They don't have any of that overhead. You're paying 20 to 30% of your total health care bill in overhead to health insurance companies, Scott.
Tom, and it's trying to argue that the government is more efficient than the market. Nobody believes that.
The government is more efficient than the market in those areas that have to do with the commons. And it's been proved over and over and over again for over 1,000 years, Scott.
No. You're wrong, Tom. Freedom works. What doesn't work is central planning. What doesn't work is government monopoly.
Freedom absolutely works. And people having the freedom to choose to collectively say, we the people are going to collectively be the insurance company for us, is the ultimate expression of freedom. It's, you know, freedom works is a great slogan from the Libertarian Party, by the way, from years ago. I like it. And I'd like to have the freedom to buy into Medicare. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
What gives you the right, hey you, to stand there and tell me what to do? Tell me, who gave you the power to stop me from living like I do? Remember, if you plan to stay, those who give and take away, don't buy the hand that feeds you.
Okay, here's their website, UnionGeneCompany.com. For Union Jeans. UnionGeneCompany.com. I should have been able to remember that. You would think, right? Sometimes it takes me a while. Anyhow, China braces for more food scarcity. By the way, in Los Angeles, let's see, 5,000 agricultural workers in Nicaragua, Costa Rica, Guatemala, Honduras, and Panama have filed 5 lawsuits in this country claiming they were left sterile after being exposed to the pesticide DBCP. So the question now is, can a company, a U.S.-based company that is operating all over the world, be sued for things that they, for in this case, fraud and negligence, that is being alleged against them by using the pesticide in other countries? So you've got that. And then there's this study that just came out. Organic fruit and vegetables are better for the heart and general health than conventionally grown crops. Double the quantity of antioxidants called flavonoids that help prevent high blood pressure and the likelihood of heart disease and strokes. From the University of California study, it's going to be published in the Fall Journal of the Agricultural and Food Chemistry. Quercetin and camphorol, both flavonoids, were on average 79% and 97% higher in organic tomatoes. These are the compounds that that help prevent high blood pressure and thus reduce the likelihood of heart disease and strokes, and also can stave off some forms of cancer and dementia. But we can get cheaper stuff made with enormous amounts of unknown pesticides from China. 1-866-303-2270. Let's see, who else wants to argue with me? I'll go there first. Richard in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Richard.
Hey. I wish you'd seen Friedman's eulogy on public television probably earlier this year, earlier in the year. In there it said Estonia, a former Soviet satellite, implemented Friedman's policies, and now they have the fastest-growing standard of living in Europe.
Yeah, I've been to Estonia. In fact, I was there. Louise and I were there when they were first making that transition. And Estonia, one of the Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, and you go north out of Poland. Actually, we did. We took the train north out of Poland and went through Latvia and Lithuania and then into Estonia, and then we took a ferry up to Denmark. And they went from being a disaster, you know, it was a former Soviet state. They went from being a disaster to growing like crazy. And you know what's growing the fastest right now in Estonia?
What?
The oligarchs. It's the same thing that's happening in the, it's the same thing that's happening in Russia right now. When I was in Dubrovnik a couple of weeks ago, there was this great big huge boat that pulled into the harbor, you know, playing loud rock and roll music and all these scantily clad ladies dancing around. It turned out it was owned by one of the Russian mafia guys. They're not even the mafia. I mean, they're businessmen, right? But they're the oligarchs, and they have people killed that they don't like. They're basically running the country. What you're seeing rise in Estonia right now, and I'm telling you, go pay attention to it. Actually, you know, don't just listen to the Milton Friedman obituaries. You're seeing the rise of oligarchy because that's what Friedmanism always leads to. You end up with a small handful of people basically owning all the resources of the country, and everybody has to work for them. And it's a destructive thing. And we passed the Sherman Act back in 1881 to stop oligarchy in the United States. And during those times in our history when it was actually being enforced, you didn't see the rise of dynastic families and dynastic corporations. And when we stopped enforcing it, boom, suddenly the middle class goes away and you get, you know, a small handful of large transnational corporations running everything. And that's what's happening in Estonia right now. It's what's happening in Russia right now, although Putin is starting to push back on it a little, oddly enough. Or is he getting in bed with them? Actually, you know, there's a big debate about that. But, that's what's going on, Richard. There's no way that you're going to sell Milton Friedman, or for that matter, Tom Friedman, to me. It ain't going to happen. Pam in Dexter, Oregon. Hey, Pam, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Well, first of all, I want to give you kudos. I'm just finishing your book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, and it's really profoundly powerful and clearly written, and I'm inspired, and I'm also angered by what's happening. And the caller that spoke a couple times ago that said you're so wrong, I mean, come on. We're subsidizing trade. There's no justice where you can get an apple from New Zealand that's cheaper than 5 miles from out of town. And so basically the golden rule is really he who owns the gold makes the rules.
Yeah, that is the bottom line of Friedmanism and the so-called free market economies. And it's not good. It's not good for democracy. It's not good for people. It's not good for all life on earth. Pam, thank you very much for your kind words and for your comments. Mike in New Jersey. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing today?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
That's good. A point I wanted to make, which is, would you agree that the people who are unemployed are also consumers? And that basically the companies keep on putting American workers out of work, but expect them to go out and buy their products that they've made cheaper overseas?
Right, and so far it's worked because what's happened is that American workers, even though their incomes are being degraded, they've been increasingly cashing out of the assets that they own. People don't own their cars anymore. They're basically renting them or leasing them. They don't own their homes anymore. They've been using their homes as ATMs, and their equity is going down. We had net negative savings last year for the first time since the Great Depression. And consumers have been able to maintain a certain level of consumption by doing this, but there's going to be an end to that game.
Well, it's just a matter of time before, to me, I think of it like a pyramid scheme.
It is.
Where you're constantly, you know, working on those type of people that, you know, you're putting them out of work, figuring they'll go work at McDonald's. And I tell people, eventually one day it's going to get to the point people who work at McDonald's won't be able to afford to eat there.
Yeah. Well, it's right now it's to the point, and there's a really interesting study that was done. And, Mike, thanks for the call and thanks for the point you made. There was a really interesting study that was done, I believe, by the Center for Science. I think it was Public Citizen, where they put together a basket full of stuff that you would need to live on. You know, just the basic stuff that you would need to live on. And said, if you bought all this stuff at Walmart, could you pay for the cost of a family of four for a year on the salary that the head of that family would earn at Walmart if you bought everything at Walmart? And the answer was no, you can't. 57 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. At 20 minutes past the hour, Terry O'Sullivan is going to be with us. He's the General President of Laborers International Union of North America for our labor update for the week. At the bottom of the hour, we're going to be talking with Lamar Waldron, who Lamar and I spent 17 years researching and ultimately writing a book about John and Bobby Kennedy and the circumstances that led to the death of John Kennedy. And we'll be talking about that and Vincent Bugliosi's book. And in the very last segment of the program, I believe Ellen Ratner from the Talk Radio News Service is going to be calling in. So we've got a busy hour. Number 10, memo to number 10 on the threat of a bomb. Ben Fenton writing over in the Financial Times today. The British people are scared. Since the detonation of a huge bomb a few months ago, destruction of their way of life by a little understood culture from the East looms over them like a dreadful specter. Worse, they have to face the destabilizing knowledge that the threat is now amplified because the distant enemy has been aided by traitors from within. Inside a jittery number 10, this is number 10 Downing Street, like their White House, the new prime minister has come under pressure from his most senior colleague and bitterest rival to pass new laws to counter such treachery. They are laws that will restrict civil liberties as they have not been restricted in peacetime for centuries. Uncertain how to face the hawks in his cabinet the next day, the prime minister turns to his cabinet secretary for advice. The civil servant replies, and this is an actual quote from an actual memo, "You should challenge the critics to say whether they are prepared to advocate powers to arrest on suspicion, to detain without trial, to extract confessions by torture, etc. Are they prepared to tear up habeas corpus and the Bill of Rights and to abandon our traditional conceptions of justice and fair dealing? Most of us are not prepared to abandon the rights and liberties and way of life which we have fought so hard to preserve. And we have enough sense of proportion to see that an occasional jihadi is not too high a price to pay for those things." Now, here's what's amazing. And Ben Fenton points it out in his article in the Financial Times. The date of the memo was October 1955. The bomb that went off was the first detonation of a nuclear device by the Soviet Union. It's like, you know, if we respond to fear by saying, okay, that's it, no more civil liberties, there's always going to be something new to be afraid of. There's always going to be something new to be afraid of. 1-866-303-2270, Frank in Middletown, New York. Hey, Frank.
Hi there. The man who talked earlier about the, you know, government can never provide services as well as business. I'd just like to tell you a little quick story. I'm 67 years old. Before I retired, I had the usual insurance policy. I paid a fortune for more, a lot of which went to executive compensation, I'm sure, and I got sick. And it was a nightmare. By the time I fought the insurance companies and my doctors fought the insurance companies for every test and every, all the rest and all the paperwork and all that. I'm now 67. I just went through two huge major operations, heart operations. They involved 12 hours between the two of them on the table. I was put in Columbia Presbyterian by Medicare, one of the finest centers in the world. I was operated on by three of the finest heart surgeons in the world. I never signed a piece of paper. I never paid a nickel. I never stood in line. Everything was taken care of. So where is the efficiency here between government and business?
Right. Well, I see you were using...
By the way, Social Security has one of the lowest overhead costs of any insurance provider in the United States.
That's right. If not the lowest. Yeah, absolutely. Because they don't have to pay profits to the corporations. And that, which is why the Bushies and all the cons want to privatize Social Security so they can start making a profit off our commons, off our Social Security, off our Medicare. Your point is well taken, Frank, and thank you for sharing that story. It's very, very well said. Matt in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Great. What's up?
Well, I had a comment on social medicine over in Europe. I have a family over there quite a bit, and we own land down in South Germany and so on. My grandmother was in her 50s. She had a heart attack and a stroke in the same night. Now, the social medicine didn't pretty much take care of her, but they told her basically that even if a heart was available, she was too old. She was going to die. That's the first one. The second one is I had another friend who was around 8 years old and kept.
Wait a second, Matt. You're saying that she didn't get a heart. She couldn't get a heart transplant.
She was not eligible for a heart transplant. The government told her she was too old.
I can give you 500 similar examples from the United States.
Yeah, exactly. And that's privatized versus socialized.
But that's just what happens when people, you know, when people who, well, first of all, you know, that's what happens when people start arguing anecdotes. The bottom line is that the countries with national health care systems have longer life, better quality life, and people don't have to live in fear that if they get sick, they're going to be wiped out.
It's still, though, the vast majority of it's taken out of taxes. I mean, you're forced into a social health care plan in Europe.
You're forced into private insurance if you want to have insurance.
They're not given a choice. I can tell you several people right now.
Do you have a choice with health insurance right now? Can you choose a health insurance company that'll say that they'll insure you regardless of previous conditions? Let's say that you've got Hep C or that you've got heart disease or you've had a heart attack. Can you choose a health insurance company?
I've never really looked into it.
Well, the answer is no, you can't in the United States. You don't have a choice. The only people in the United States who have any kind of significant choice of health insurance providers, and it's a choice between Tweedledee and Tweedledum, are people in the 20s who are healthy. Because those are, in fact, what we're seeing right now is a growing trend of private for-profit health insurance companies in the United States finding reasons to dump people in their 50s and 60s who have any even small health problems, literally dumping them off the program and into the ranks of the 45 million uninsured in the United States. I got a note here from Dan in Gresham, Oregon, listening to the program. He says, Tom, I've been listening to you for going on a year now. I was listening the other day, and you mentioned that you lived in Germany. And I did, and I lived there for along with Louise and our three kids, and we used the German healthcare system. We lived there for a year, 86, 87. He says, I married a German girl and lived in Nuremberg for 9 years. Our son was born there and is a dual national. The reason I'm writing is to tell my experience with the healthcare system there. He says, I insured myself and my family for about $200 per month. Now, this is in Germany. It's not taken out of your taxes. You pay into this national health insurance single payer program. He says, I never had a single bad experience in 9 years. I always saw a doctor when I needed to, and when I needed a prescription, I was asked to pay a $5, $2.25 at that time copay. When our son was born, my wife was in the hospital for a week, and when we went home, a midwife came to our apartment every day for an additional 2 weeks to make sure we were making out all okay. All this and not 1 cent out of my pocket. Later, my son had respiratory problems and pneumonia twice. He was in the hospital for 2 months. My wife stayed with him, and again, not 1 cent was billed to us. We received state-of-the-art medical care by trained professional medical workers, and I, for one, am sold on their system. Also, I'm sure you're aware that most Germans have a pretty good quality of life, and they understand it's important that a health care system be there. And if this means a little more taxes, that's the cost of civilized health care. Thank you, Dan. And here's another note from Rita in Snohomish, Washington. She says, my husband was sent on business to England, so I joined him. We met some wonderful people who invited us to their home. It was about a 3.5-hour drive from our hotel. When I got there, I realized I'd forgotten my insulin. I just told my host that I wouldn't eat. They said, you can't do that, and insisted on taking me to the emergency room to get a prescription for insulin. We went to the emergency room in the village that they lived in, and the doctor had just left, so they suggested we go to the doctor in the next town. We went to that hospital. I was the second person waiting to see the doctor. We waited for approximately 10 minutes. I have chronic pancreatitis and have waited as long as 6 hours to see a doctor in the emergency room in the United States when I was having an attack. Normal wait time in the United States is 4 hours. Each time I've been admitted to the hospital, it has been extremely miserable to be doubled up in pain and have to wait so long in an ER to see a doc. People with colds sometimes go in before me. When I filled my prescription in England, it cost me less than what my copay is here in the States. And I'm a firm believer in national health care, she says. Anyhow, Amy in San Diego, California. Hey, Amy.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to bring up the point. I'm not sure if everybody is saying that we want socialized medicine, you know, government to run our medical system. I think that we just want the government to run the health insurance part.
Right. We want the government to pay for it, not to,
right.
Not,
exactly.
Not to pay the, yeah. Right. And that's the difference between single-payer and socialized medicine. We have socialized medicine in the Veterans Administration, and we have single-payer in Medicare. And Medicare, in my opinion, works better than the VA.
Yes, I totally agree. And right now, you don't get to decide how your medical care is going to happen, and neither does your doctor. It's up to your health insurance company. My family has a history of breast cancer, and they found a lump in me. I have three sisters and a mother with breast cancer, and they would not let me have an MRI to check out a lump. They refused.
Good grief.
Because, they're betting on me not getting it. Oh,
yeah, because they're trying to save money so that they can pay more money to their CEO. Amy, thank you very much for sharing your story, and I'm sorry to hear about your health problems. But we really need to get our act together in this country. Go see Sicko, by the way, Michael Moore's new movie. It's brilliant. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
We've taken all you there's a certain comfort to know that the promises made will be kept by the government. You don't have to worry.
That's good, because I work three jobs and I feel like I contribute.
You work three jobs?
Three jobs, yes.
Uniquely American, isn't it? I mean, that is fantastic that you're doing that.
Thank you.
You get any sleep?
Minutes past the hour. Yeah, Mr. President. How about the working man and woman here in the United States? Terry O'Sullivan's with us, the general president of the Laborers International Union of North America, a progressive activist union formed in 1903 and still out there representing over 700,000 people across the United States. LIUNA.org is the website. Terry, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom, very much. I got a kick listening to the intro when the president says that's uniquely American to have three jobs. I know we wish that he just do one right.
Yeah, there you go. Well, and also it is uniquely American because in most other industrialized democracies, where you have very high levels of unionization, the developed countries of the world, you can support one family with one good union job.
Unfortunately, today, Tom.
Yeah.
Difficult to do, particularly with this administration and the last 12 years, what working people have gone through is absolutely atrocious.
Yeah. Terry, by the way, your phone is breaking up there. If you've got a wire that you need to be careful not to pull on or something, I don't know. But how are unions and how do you pronounce, is it LIUNA?
Yeah, LIUNA.
LIUNA, thank you. And LIUNA in particular responding to the state of working America. And what is the state of working America, in your opinion?
Well, I think the state of a working America, we've weathered an avalanche, not a storm, working people have over the course of the last 12 years. I view people talk about organized labor and where we're at and the strength of organized labor. And organized labor is as strong as it ever has been. Our numbers may be down, but if you take what's happened to not only organized labor, but working people over the course of the last 12 years, we've been trying to hold on.
Well, it's not just the 12 years. I mean, it was 1981 when Ronald Reagan declared war against working people by busting Patco and just came right out and said he was going to make the Labor Department hostile to labor.
It has been going on for decades, but the last 12 years in particular have been absolutely brutal. You know, and actually George Bush is the best way, and this conservative Republicans have been the best weapon that we have in organized labor to motivate not only our membership, but working people.
That's true.
You think about what's up and what's down, I mean, hell, the price of gas is up, the cost of college tuition, the cost, not only the cost of health care, but the number of individuals without health care. We have 47 million Americans that don't have health coverage. The number of individuals, who are on poverty, 37 million. Trade deficit is up. The budget deficit is up. The conservative Republicans' foot has been up the backside of working people for the last 12 years. And as you said, more than that, go back to 81 with Ronald Reagan. Down in this country is wages, medium household income is down. At this point, Tom, the number of workers covered by a defined benefit pension plan in 1983, 87% of working people were covered by a pension plan. In 2005, it's 37%. I mean, it's time. We believe in 2008 you're going to see another resurgence of organized labor as you did in the 06 elections. In 08, when we take back the White House, when we increase our numbers in the House of Representatives and increase our numbers in the Senate, I think you're going to be able to see a progressive and aggressive pro-working family, pro-working men and women agenda in this country.
We're talking with Terry O'Sullivan, the General President of Labor's International Union of North America, LIUNA, LIUNA.org, the website. Terry, we just saw Republicans successfully block in the Senate. They filibustered it. They prevented the Senate from voting on card check, which would allow anybody to join a union simply by, signing a card. This is a bit of a setback, frankly. It was the first serious attempt to roll back Taft-Hartley. Where do we go from here? What's LIUNA doing, and what's labor doing in general, specifically? We have about a minute, by the way, before we got to take a break.
I think specifically what we got to do is we have to keep the pressure on. While we didn't get it passed in this Congress, I think that we're going to have to tee things up for the 2009. We're going to have to make sure that we win the presidency, so we have a president that will sign the Employer Free Choice Act. We got to increase our ranks in the Senate and increase our numbers, Democratic representatives in the House, so that this legislation, when passed, will be veto-proofed. So we keep doing what we've done. While it didn't pass this time, we don't give up hope. We keep fighting. We are successful in the 08 elections and then tee it up again for 2009.
Great. Yeah, well said. And people can learn more about it over at what you guys are doing over at liuna.org, liuna.org. Terry O'Sullivan, the general president of the Laborers International Union of North America. We got to keep organizing and keep spreading the word, Terry.
That's it, Tom.
Thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program right here on Air America Radio. Stick around. We're going to be talking about who killed Kennedy and how and why and most importantly, why right after this break.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
In 1961, when Ike went out, the people in the South began to shout. In the last 8 years, everybody starved to death. The people up in Lucknow ain't even got breath. Please, Mr. Kennedy, won't you help us out?
Yeah, that was a song from the era. Welcome back, 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. As you know, as you may know, Lamar Waldron and I wrote a book called Ultimate Sacrifice. The website Ultimate Sacrifice, the book. And there's about the Kennedy assassination. And there's a new book out by Vincent Bugliosi called Reclaiming History. And we invited Mr. Bugliosi to be on this program, and he accepted our invitation, and then I'm not sure what happened, he decided that he wasn't going to be on the program. But I still think that his book and our book, there should be a discussion about it. And it really even goes beyond all this stuff. So with us today, Lamar Waldron, who Lamar and I researched this book for 17 years. Lamar did the yeoman's chunk of the writing of it, Ultimate Sacrifice. And if that's a rational phrase or a good English language phrase, Lamar, welcome.
Great to be here, Tom.
And Lamar, what I'm going to do, you know, having gone through Mr. Bugliosi's book, I'm going to take some of his points and just toss them out and see if we can have some semblance of, you know, both sides of this argument anyway. First of all, about our book.
Well, yeah, let me just briefly say what our book is, because it's very different from Mr. Bugliosi's book. Because, you know, we interviewed almost two dozen associates of John and Robert Kennedy. What they told us was backed up by thousands of declassified files at the National Archives, files that anybody can see. And we have some of them on our website, ultimatesacrificethebook.com. And you know, you and I uncovered, this is many years ago, something so secret that even today it keeps the United States from normalizing relations with Cuba and helping Americans to get some of those Cuban oil reserves that could help our gas prices today. So what you and I discovered was that when JFK died, John and Robert Kennedy were getting ready to stage what would appear to be a palace coup against Fidel Castro that would have been followed by a U.S. invasion that would have been invited in by JFK's secret coup leader high in the Cuban government, number three man in Cuba at that time, the Cuban Army commander Juan Almeida. Now, as for why things were so secret today, if somebody goes to the CIA's website and they look up the leaders of Cuba today, they will see that Commander Juan Almeida is still listed number three today. But so how does this tie into the assassination in a way much different than Bugliosi? Well, Robert Kennedy, with the backing of his brother John, was waging a huge war against the mafia, the biggest war America has ever seen against the mafia, especially targeting the mafia families in Chicago, Tampa, and who controlled Louisiana and Dallas. Now, though the mafia in general was barred from this coup plan, they were going to be barred from reopening their casinos after the coup was successful, hopefully for JFK. So these mafia bosses, three in particular, who were being heavily targeted by the Kennedys, managed to infiltrate this top-secret coup plan using their CIA contacts, because the CIA had been and was still running some unauthorized operations with the mafia they hadn't told the Kennedys about. And these three mafia bosses managed to try to assassinate JFK, first trying in Chicago, 3 weeks before Dallas, something that was kept secret until the 70s. Then in Tampa, Florida, 4 days before Dallas, something that was kept secret then and literally until our book came out. And then finally they succeeded in Dallas. But because the mafia had so connected JFK's murder, even to the bullets in Oswald's rifle, to this top-secret coup plan, Bobby Kennedy and even his enemies, Lyndon Johnson and J. Edgar Hoover, had to work together to prevent World War III. This was just a year after the Cuban Missile Crisis, and also to protect Almeida, remained undetected in Cuba, and his family.
Right, because he was our guy.
And so they had to cover up so much information from the Warren Commission and from each other. And Almeida stayed in power. Fidel didn't find out till 1990. You and I couldn't even name him in our hardback.
Yeah, and we found out back in the 80s.
That's right. I mean, we finally revealed his identity in last September in our trade paperback. But so much is still secret today. A million files are still being withheld from Congress about this, despite the 1992 JFK Act. And there's so much that would embarrass people from earlier cover-ups. For instance, Warren Commissioner Gerald Ford was president, you know, in the mid-70s. His chief of staff was a man by the name of Dick Cheney. His CIA director was George Bush, the current president's father. And they withheld a lot of this information about Commander Almeida, the top-secret CIA plan, AM World, and the mafia's infiltration then. So to bring all that out now would be hugely embarrassing to those people. So that's why so much is secret today. And that's really what our book is about, in contrast to Mr. Bugliosi's.
Our book is about embarrassing Dick Cheney. Okay, Mr. Bugliosi says, and I quote, this is from page 26, I guess, of the foreword. He says, Oswald killed Kennedy and acted alone. On page 967, he says, there's 53 pieces of evidence pointing towards his guilt. On page 1439, this is his book, Reclaiming History, Vincent Bugliosi. He says, there are 32 points of evidence of no conspiracy.
What do you think? You know, the Warren Commission, the first of the six government committees to investigate JFK's death, was the least informed. They weren't told about AM World. They weren't told about Almeida. They weren't told about the Tampa plot. They weren't told about the CIA mafia plots to kill Fidel. So they had so much withheld. Later committees found so much information, they either had to have later investigations, and the last congressional committee to look at this concluded that there had been a conspiracy, and they named two of the godfathers that we named, the New Orleans Dallas godfather Carlos Marcello and Santo Trafficante of Tampa, as having the motive, means, and the opportunity to have murdered JFK.
Yeah. So, Mr. Bugliosi, on page 1384 of his book, Reclaiming History. By the way, do you know his website for his book, Lamar? I don't have that.
Yeah, we should give that. It is, I just checked it, it's reclaiminghistory.com.
Okay, great. So, you know, just have all sorts of representatives
here. One other thing I should mention quickly, so many of these things, like, you know, Bugliosi, as you mentioned, 32 points of evidence, 53 pieces of evidence, most of this stuff has been debunked years, if not decades ago, and I can give you a great example. He says about Oswald, if anyone was ever a committed Marxist, starting from when he began reading Das Kapital in his early teens, it was Oswald. He says that on page 1384 of his book. Just absurd. Ask yourself, Tom, your listeners can ask themselves, how many teenage Marxists do you know that ever joined the Civil Air Patrol? How many teenage Marxists do you know that not only joined the U.S. Marines, this is back in the 50s, the McCarthy era, almost, but they tried to join a year before they were old enough. And in the Marines, he went around spouting Russian, learning Russian, and praising Russia so much, his buddies called him Osvaldovich, and yet he was never once reprimanded or even cited once by his CO. And once he came back to America after a supposed defection, he avoided meetings of real communists like the plague. And so he comes back to America from Russia with a Russian wife. Where does he get a job in Dallas? He gets a job at a Dallas company that helps to make maps from U-2 spy plane photos, and that's during the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis. So, yeah. You know, Oswald's clearly not your typical teenage Marxist.
Yeah. So in Mr. Bugliosi's book, he claims that former House Speaker Tip O'Neill was, quote, obviously confused, end quote, when he stated in his own autobiography that Dave Powers and Kenny O'Donnell, who were two of JFK's top aides, and they were in the car right behind him at the time of the assassination, when they told Tip O'Neill that they saw the shots come from in front, or they saw a shot come from in front, Mr. Bugliosi says O'Neill must have been confused.
Well, and
the Speaker of the House?
Tip O'Neill's only one of many government officials and investigators that Mr. Bugliosi takes to task and basically results to personal attacks. You know, you and I investigated this, and you know, we arranged for you to talk to Dave Powers at the John F. Kennedy Library.
Yeah, as far as I know, in fact, I'm the only person who spoke with Dave Powers about this. He was very reluctant to talk about it on the record, but at the time, I owned an ad agency down in Atlanta, and we were doing consulting work for the JFK Library, and I was working with these people, and Dave sat down and we had a long conversation. He signed a copy of Time magazine for me, and he told me the story about how he and Kenny were in the car, and he said he saw the shot from in front, from that hill that they call it the grassy knoll, and he said it's all in the book. I mean,
and the bottom line people should know is he and O'Donnell, these two JFK aides, they told Tip O'Neill, you know, they were forced to change their testimony. O'Donnell said later it was for the good of the country. Yeah. We even dug up it was Magic Bullet Arlen Specter that took Powers' very slanted and pressured affidavit. So again, you know, this is just very typical of what's in Bugliosi's book, but you can learn the full story in our book.
In our book, Ultimate Sacrifice, thebook.com. And finally, we just have 45 seconds here, Lamar. Mr. Bugliosi in his book writes about us in our book, says that we present a CIA memo. One can't be sure it's legitimate since it looks like one, like no U.S. intelligence memo I've ever seen. Huh?
Well, what he leaves out is most of the information in our book came from, you know, a lot of it came from documents from the National Archives. That particular document, we quote it, we give the document number. Anybody can go to the National Archives and find it. It doesn't look like most CIA files because the House Committee investigators weren't allowed to take the CIA files with them. They had to make these handwritten and hand-typed little summaries. All of your basic investigators know that kind of thing. So, again, the full information is there. People can go to ultimatesacrificethebook.com to find out more.
Okay, ultimatesacrificethebook.com for our book. Vincent Bugliosi's book, Reclaiming History, reclaiminghistory.com. Lamar Waldron, thank you very much, Lamar, for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Tom. I appreciate it.
45 minutes past the hour.
Tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Street is our winner, so I say congratulations to 60th Street, blogging over at airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page. 60th Street says, your last caller willfully ignores the obvious. America has public education, and anyone can send their kids to a private school if they can afford it. Public education did not do away with private education. It just allowed everyone to be educated to a socially acceptable standard instead of just those who could afford it. I doubt anyone wants to imagine what the education system would be like if we were to run it the way the health industry is run today. Yikes! Good, great blog post, 60th Street. Thank you very much, David picked it out, and so we will send you a copy, an autographed copy of Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, by me. So you will get Screwed by Tom Hartman. Ellen Ratner on the line. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much. Actually, despite some of the leaks in the press reports, about the White House beginning to consider a drawdown on our troops. Tony Snow said this morning that benchmarks are not going to be met within the first few months, and it's just the beginning of something, and there is absolutely no debate on withdrawing forces from Iraq. Now, you know, you can believe what you want to believe, but that's certainly what they're saying in public, and who knows what eventually they'll wind up doing. Also, there were dueling letters today on two separate issues. White House counsel Fred Fielding wrote a letter to the House and Senate Judiciary chairs and saying that they would he would make Sarah Taylor and Harriet Myers in a private, off-the-record, no-transcript meeting, and that this this wanting them to testify represents substantial encroachment into presidential prerogatives. Then John Conyers wrote a letter to President Bush saying that he wanted him to waive executive privilege and to have documents released relating to the Valerie Plame incident. So both of those are sort of dueling issues. Now
may I interrupt you at that before you move on to the next topic?
Sure.
Fred Fielding was the assistant to John Dean in the Nixon White House. And when John Dean came out and told the truth about what he knew about Nixon, you know, he lost his job, and Fielding became Nixon's guy. Fielding removed items from E. Howard Hunt's safe and destroyed them. Fielding stonewalled Congress. He advised Nixon to stonewall Congress. Fred Fielding, the current White House counsel, was Nixon's White House counsel, that have these V bottoms that don't blow up when they go over an IED.
Exactly. And so, I mean, the supplemental, if you really look at the supplemental, yeah, there's some fork in it, but a lot of it was to provide troops to help the Humvees and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, it's pretty amazing.
I just don't get it. Why
going to attack it?
Yeah, I'm just astounded that the White House would attack that stuff. It's like, you know, Bush just doesn't care. I mean, it just astounds me.
But when the heat gets bad in the kitchen, then what you need to do is deflect. Why not go after the Democrats and call them spendthrifts?
Yeah. Well, you know, hopefully the media will tell the truth about this. You know, it's what else is going on in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The House does not have much on their schedule. The defense authorization bill is very big. There's going to be a meeting on Thursday on the possibility of what might happen with the radiological bomb. I'm actually, for the first time in 13 and a half years covering the White House, am going to travel with the president tomorrow because he's going to Cleveland, Ohio, my hometown, and I decided that I really wanted to sort of see, because I know most of the people that will be going to the events, see how he's really going to be connecting to a very important state. So you'll actually hear from me tomorrow. We may have to jimmy around with the time from Cleveland.
Oh, that should be fascinating. I mean, it'd be very fascinating to hear your thoughts on how Bush connects with the people in the audience and that kind of thing, too.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Ellen, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 56 minutes past the... Well, it's wrapping up the show here today. Coming up Tuesday, tomorrow, I'll be confronting conservative Kafir Alfia on his book, A Field Guide to Left-Wing Wackos. Joseph A. Califano Jr. is here with his new book. Robin Simon is dropping by with a question, will the electorate be equal 50% women by the year 2020? Plus, as always, the best of the rest of the news and your calls. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.